The thing that I'm most preoccupied with in the Divine Cities Foundry side and the Tainted Cup is change, is how circumstances require change, how the evolution and suddenly the rights of people, the resources they have, permit them to change themselves, to change how they prefer to live, to allow them to become more of themselves. And how change often leads to conflict, to disruption, to situations that at first seem better, but maybe not are. And that's probably why a lot of my works are more akin to science fiction than they are to fantasy, because fantasy frequently looks backward. I'm not the first one to point this out, but there was a post today about how, like, if you were a kid who grew up before the internet, then it's a little like being an elf from Tolkien's world who saw the last light of the two trees. And I was like, oh, okay. But like that kind of speaks to that trope in fantasy of there once was a wonderful world, but then through the follies of men, or through like mortals or whoever, things went terribly awry, and now everything is broken and ruined. And if we could only get the right person on the throne, maybe we could regain some shred of that power. This kind of functions alongside the Garden of Eden, which is like once there was paradise, we fucked it all up. It's impossible to go back.
What is up, everybody? You're listening to episode 90 of SFF Addicts. I'm your host, Adrian M. Gibson, and welcome to your weekly dive into the world of science fiction, fantasy, and writing craft. Joining me, as always, is my co-host, the Chewie to my Han Solo, the Joker to my Commander Shepard, MJ Kuhn. How's it going, MJ?
Hi there. I'm doing lovely. How are you?
Doing very well. I'm not in my parents' basement, but I'm at my in-laws' bedroom, so that's, you know, it's a good time.
You're on the road today.
I'm on the road,
a
man.
Field
I just, like,
reporter.
Packed up. Yeah, I just packed up all my shit as well. If you would like to support this lovely human being, MJ Kuhn, and her work, you can buy Among Thieves and its awesome sequel, Thick as Thieves, which is a complete duology for all your ass-kicking needs and thieving and heists and all that fun stuff. And we talked about heists with Robert Jackson Bennett, so you're going to get a I don't know how many doses of that in these books. So you're going to have a good time.
So many doses. Yeah. I love that you brought them with you, with your setup. I didn't think you'd have them with you today because you're on the road.
I gotta my girl's books.
Oh my God, that's amazing.
As well, you can check out the official cover for my debut novel, Mushroom Blues. The reveal happened when we're recording in the past right now, but it happened on January 17th, so you can check that out. The book is out on March 19th, so stay tuned for more info on that if you want some mushrooms and police procedurals and all kinds of icky, sticky stuff. It's going to be a good time. as well, a quick note for listeners, the official SFF Addicts Patreon and merch store are live, so check the links in the description to support what we do here. You can also rate and review the podcast on your favorite podcast app and subscribe to the FamFatic YouTube channel where this and every other episode of the show is available in full video. And now, welcoming today's guest, Robert Jackson Bennett, award-winning author of the Founders Trilogy, the Divine Cities Trilogy, and more, including the soon-to-be-released The Tainted Cup. I even brought Robert's books.
Oh, wow.
There's Foundry's Side.
There's hardcover too, that's heavy.
Stairs. Oh yeah. And yeah, welcome back to SFF Addicts, Robert. How are you doing?
It's great to be back here.
Yeah, man. Thanks for being here and very excited to chat about your new book. But let's kick things off with an introduction for listeners who aren't familiar with you, your work. Can you tell us a little bit about yourself?
Sure. I write stories that operate as different stories but are dressed up as fantasy. Like, for example, The Divine Cities is a spy trilogy that looks like a fantasy. Foundry Side series is cyberpunk that looks like fantasy. And The Tainted Cup is a murder mystery that is dressed up as a fantasy. There's beards, there's swords, there's magic, there's towers, there's occasionally horses. There's all those things. But the guts, the machinery underneath it, the pistons that fire, the tracks that it runs on, those are different from what I think a lot of people have ingrained in their heads as a fantasy story, i.e. the young farm boy gets a relic and has to go save the world, or kings and queens duking it out, trying to kill each other's families in order to gain control of the throne. That kind of stuff. There is some of that, but the way that it operates, the point of the story, the beats, the cadences, those are different.
Yeah, I explained to MJ, because she's reading your Founders Trilogy books, and then she read The Tainted Cup, but she hasn't read The Divine Cities, and I explained to her.
Yeah, not yet.
It's basically like a Cold War spy thriller, but like dressed up in like Eastern European fantasy.
And I was like, yes, please.
Yes, please. Yeah. No, that's good stuff, man. Yeah.
Yeah.
Before we dig deeper into the episode, a quick word from our sponsor. Novello is an exciting new publishing and reading platform whose goal is to be the go-to for all things writing and storytelling. Their platform offers an intuitive, user-friendly way for writers to create and share their awesome stories for readers to enjoy, all while maintaining total control over their stories. Everything from the content to cover art and pricing is all controlled by the story's author. Novello also offers social features such as message boards, direct messaging, and a news feed, where you can post updates to your followers. With future plans including support for comics and a marketplace for users to sell other writing-related services, the future of this platform is looking bright. And the best part? It's all available for free. No sign-up fees, no membership, just a growing library of epic tales. Sign up now to bask in the magic of books, where you can enjoy tales like Blackwater, an epic adventure by an award-winning author, or Limbo, The Door Above the Lake, a terrifying battle for survival. Whether you're a casual reader or a professional writer, Novello is the place for you. Visit them at novello.com. That's N-O-V-E-L-O.com. And now, enjoy the rest of this episode of SFF Addicts.
Well, we're all big nerds here, obviously, and we always like to talk with our guests about the nerd media that made them into the big old lovable nerd that they are today. So, do you have books, movies, games, anything that you remember from growing up that you would consider like your nerd gateway drug?
Let's see here. Well, I was the younger kid, so a lot of stuff that I got was hand-me-downs or what my brother was reading at the time, which means like the younger kid always grows up faster. And I recall reading things like Narnia and I really liked reading that one backwards. I liked, The Magician's, Nephew. That was my favorite one. Cause that one was all fucked up.
So
when they went to like the Red World, that one was my favorite. And I wrote, you'll have to pardon, my kid is playing the next room. So if you hear any hooting and hollering, he's gaming with a friend. His friend's there, which is a little bit better. They're gaming right next to each other. On top of that, one of the things that really got me going was in junior high, a friend of mine was like, have you ever heard of this game called Warhammer 40K? And I found actually playing the game pretty shitty.
Me too.
I really liked making the models, and I really liked reading the codexes and reading the weird little arcane rules about all the unique characters. But when it came down to actually sitting down and getting the dice and the rulers out and all that crap and having to buy, like, you know, the templates for, like, what the flame – what, like, the flamethrowers
like
would do.
Yeah, like the thing that looks like a part of, like, a geometry set.
Like an ice cream
cone. Or like an ice cream cone, but, like, part of a geometry set.
Yeah, I was dramatically less interested in that. Yeah, because, I mean, like, it was just a lot of work, a lot of logistics to determine who won, and I found the lore of the game way more fascinating. So that was a big part of it as well. I remember reading lots of those, lots of Tolkien. I reread Tolkien just this past year. It is really interesting where you can see the books, like, change from being a delightful story to being more of a saga. People start saying behold a lot. Behold! And generally, once you start beholding things, you can tell you're in a different kind of story. It goes from like it goes into real high fantasy mode, which is just kind of interesting to see now that you're a little bit older. But yeah, all that kind of stuff I was really into. I still feel like among all my friends, I'm the least, like they consider me the least nerdy one, which is interesting because among all the normies that I know, no one knows what the fuck I'm talking about. So I guess like for my other friends, they must be real nerds. Like where like 100% of their hobbies and activities are devoted to people with blasters or swords. But yeah, that kind of sums it up, I think.
Just like the shifting gradient of nerdiness is like,
right.
Who knows anymore?
I know. Well, that's, I've experienced that too, though, where I have friend groups where it's like, I am definitely like the least, I have no idea what they're talking about, but then I consider myself like pretty dorky. So it's like, okay, where am I on this continuum? Like,
I'm a fantasy author. What are you
doing? Yeah. I mean, I feel like I get pretty good bona fides, but like, Scavenger's Reign. Like, have you guys watched that on HBO recently?
Yeah, yeah.
It's really good.
It is.
Like, I can't find anyone in my life to recommend that to. And like, because like, I'm like, it's really mystical and science fiction-y and violent and creepy. And they're like, no. And I also like, but like I'm on my nerd fans. Like, I can't get them to watch it either. It's the craziest thing. So like, I don't know. There's this weird, like, strata of nerdery that I occupy where no one else is.
I feel like we occupy a pretty similar space. I'm so happy you mentioned Warhammer 40K. We talked with Ken Liu and he dropped Philip K. Dick and I was so excited. But you dropping Warhammer 40K, I had the exact same experience. My brother, all he wanted to do was play the actual game. And I'm just like, just go away. I just want to paint and read like the codex and buy the books and just like, no, I don't want to do that shit.
Yeah, no, it's a lot of work. I like the thing that was good about the codexes was that they always suggest this stuff happening off the page. Mm-hmm. You don't really comprehend exactly what's happening. And that's one of the great things about world building. Like the way that works best is when it suggests as opposed to say explicitly what's happening here. Like I remember there's one character for the Chaos Army that you can do, who basically wants his, he was like guarded by some sort of pan-dimensional god creature that has no name. And when his hit points drop too low, he would teleport from the map and not be counted as a death. And I was like,
so cool.
Huh? Yeah. Like that's super cool. But I don't, it's great. Anyway, stuff like that would just get your brain going, but like make you start trying to think things on your own.
Yeah, but that's exactly it, because it's like engaging you a bit more because you have to incorporate your own imagination into the experience. And I was curious, like, do you remember the moment you decided that you wanted to write your own fiction, or at least like things that kind of pushed you along that path and getting towards, you know, eventually publishing?
Yeah, it was Warcraft 3 was coming out, and this was way before social media, so there were only forums. And there was a fan fiction forum for Warcraft 3. And I started writing crap for fun and people really liked it. And I was like, wow, am I good at this? I'm sure it was shit. I'm sure it was absolute garbage because I was 12 or 13. And I can't imagine that it was anything good. And it was also about Warcraft 3. But I was trying to write these all these dark, dramatic stories set in this world that hadn't existed yet. Like the game hadn't come out, so you didn't know all the stories and stuff like that. So it was like in anticipation of it. And seeing people respond positively to my stories was like really exciting. And that was one of the moments where I was like, maybe I can do this professionally.
Yeah.
For sure. Well, we have the Founders Trilogy, we have the Divine Cities Trilogy, but I want to talk about like some of the bigger lessons that you've learned from your earlier works. So like Mr. Shivers, American Elsewhere, those kinds of tales. Mm-hmm. What kind of lessons did you learn from those early projects and how are you finding ways to apply them all these years later?
They're very different. I would say it's trickier with secondary worlds because there's a lot more work that you have to do. That's why it's actually very, very hard to get, I found, a secondary world below like 130K that feels like word-wise, that feels like it's got a lot of meat going on. or has the appropriate level of world building that people are expecting, because you just have to do so much work to put to create these cool set pieces with suggested history and things like that, and then get them wrapped up in the plot. As far as those earlier works, though, they really taught me the importance of voice, because they were describing our own world, but slightly different. And it was a lot about how you can take earthly things, and in the describing of them or the presentation of them, like whether or not it's a train or a theater or a neighborhood or a downtown, the way that you can describe them can feel unearthly and strange, and feel like it has a different set of rules applied to it. There's a lot of folks who do this great. I was a young white man with too much like schooling, which meant I was super into Cormac McCarthy. Every boy like that goes through a phase. It's very regrettable. But he is one of the masters of that, of making these earthly things feel strange and spectral and mythic. So that really taught me how to sort of shift voice and turn on a dime and make people feel like they had just entered a place with different stakes, different rules, like a different world entirely.
Yeah, because it's, like Cormac McCarthy, I think we talked about him a little bit before, but like the ways in which he just kind of manipulates our perceptions of normalcy. And yeah, like I love how you use the word spectral, because spectral is a really good word for something like Blood Meridian, which is like a time period which feels obviously it's distant from us, but there's a familiarity, especially for people who live in America. But reading that book, it's just like, it's amazing how one can make reality feel otherworldly. It's amazing how one can make something like a book about, you know, the American Southwest feel like almost fantastical. You know what I mean?
Yeah. And it, like, it's interesting because I'd argue that that book is actually one of his most like accessible, because it has dudes on horses with guns.
Right.
Some of his really like Faulknerian stuff that he did before that is really dark. I think one opens up with a girl giving birth in the woods and it's stillborn. She buries it in the dirt and it's like an incestuous baby. Like it was written to take place in like the 20s or 30s. I can't recall the name of the story, but I remember the description of like the woods, and I was like, I have never read a fantasy story that manages to nail the mythic, strange feeling of a place as well as this right now. Now, I had a bunch of $5 words that I think most editors would immediately be like, nope, you're not Cormac McCarthy. You can't do that. But that like the word that I use is like elevation, like almost as though you've consumed a drug and it's just starting to kick in. When you walk into places like that, there's almost a psychedelic feel to it. And that was something that I definitely wanted to put in a big way in The Tainted Cup, where because in stuff like Foundry Side, they're like people read that because they love the rules. Like the people who like come to that and stay there, they like the like engineering aspect of how all of this works. But in The Tainted Cup, when you get close to magic, where it's close to the like unearthly, it's trapped in the main character's head and he doesn't know the rules, which means that these moments feel larger, mythic, hyper real. And that's a little bit more fun for me personally to write in. And Foundry Side, I do a lot of tinkering, like engineering, trying to make rules feel delightful. Making rules feel delightful is not easy or fun. I would get notes from like my editor, which would say like, you need to have this conclude in the same place, but just a little bit more delightful, a little bit more pizzazz here. Just make that happen. And I was like, great.
You're like, cool, no more pressure.
Just throw in some pizzazz, Robert. That's all it needs.
It's like, you're so funny. Why don't you tell some jokes? And you're like, oh, hi, I just met all these people. So that was trickier. And so try like the high fantasy aspects of The Tainted Cup, where it is someone beholding these things that are uncanny, It is a little bit more in my wheelhouse, I would say.
Yeah, because that's something you did in the Divine Cities trilogy as well, is you played a lot with the boundaries between normal and uncanny in really fun and like creepy ways. I would say more creepy than funny and pizzazz and all that kind of stuff. But
creepy can be pizzazz.
Sure, MJ. Some creepy pizzazz is all you need in life. But I like how you're doing a little bit of compare and contrast between some of the stuff that you've written. You know, with the Founders trilogy, it's one of your more well-known works. Could you tell us a bit more about how the idea for Foundryside came to be, but then also how you went about creating the magic system? And then later on, we can touch a little bit on the Tainted Cup and your approaches for that.
Sure. Like, I'd had the idea for a long time of trying to write a series that would attack what magic was. Because in a lot of stories, magic is nonsense. It's mostly like a ball of light that you learn how to shoot with your hands, but you have to make yourself feel a certain way to do it. It doesn't make a lot of sense. And the thing that really got me into it was Harry Potter, which is very whimsical, but then builds on the whimsy to a degree that like the first books are all whimsy. And then later on, it gets to be serious. Like, here's a government made out of whimsy. And you're like, that doesn't work. You start to have these questions. Like,
lies.
Yeah, like they are taught that there's like a little tool that they have that has the hair of a unicorn embedded in it. And that they have to hold it and move it and stand it in a certain way and say Latin words, like specific Latin words, and also cultivate an emotion within themselves while they do all this to alter reality, to create birds or to shoot water or things like that. And I thought, like, how would someone figure that out? How would someone like experiment to get there? And not have this
intuition, Robert.
Intuition.
Yeah, intuition. Or did God tell them? Is this divine? I started thinking, like, how would one create a magic system that you could actually explore naturally, try and like iterate towards success, where the rules could be explored and somewhat comprehended? And my first idea was to create a magic system that functioned like law, like legal codes, with where a spell is a contract with reality saying, you're going to change this way once I do all this stuff. And then you'd have to sign it. But then there would be all these guys with a lot of degrees and a lot of comprehension who could find loopholes in the law to get around stuff. This is classic, like, fairy stuff, basically. But I wanted to make it like a system that could be exploited and abused on a mass scale. I thought that sounded kind of fun. And so I was actually at a hotel. I remember I was at a hotel in Houston, in a Hampton Inn, trying to figure out how the shower worked because it was one of those new ones. And I remember thinking, like, wouldn't it be a lot easier if I made this more like code, if this is more like software? Where you have to define a thing and then call upon that thing you defined and put in the correct syntax, and it all had to work together or else something would explode. And I was like, yeah, that works. And then I thought, okay, well, then this is just cyberpunk. This is magic is cyberpunk, where you have these gigantic tech firms that create magical items, magical systems, and all of their spells are intellectual property that they want to guard very, very closely. If you understand how all of that works, you can abuse it and use it the same way that hackers do. And it's been kind of unearthly now. So just to make this clear, there is a point at which the main character, Sancha, finds a key that can talk to all these magical rules when it's touched to it and trick them. Because when you write all these rules on an object, it gains a level of sentience. It says, like, here's my instructions, here's my programming, here's what I am to do. And when she touches Clef to it, both she and Clef can hear these instructions being said to itself again and again. And Clef can argue with it and talk it into doing things that it wouldn't normally do. The classic one is trying to get through a door, and the door says it's supposed to stay locked. I am not permitted to swing open, like under no circumstances, except if I'm presented with the correct like signals, will I open? And Clef says, well, what if you open the other way? What if you swing the other way? Does that count as opening? If you swing the other way, that's not breaking the rules. And it's like, that's a good point. And then it opens. He breaks the door open because he tricked it into doing something that they did not plan for. It has been a little bit weird to, in the age of ChatGPT and all these language models, seeing people argue with them into accessing like large reams of data or getting to do or like getting them to do things that they are not programmed to do. And seeing people say, hey, this is like Clef and Foundry side.
Yeah.
And I'm like, huh, I didn't think this would be happening so fast. I didn't, this was not something that I thought would, that I'd be seeing in my lifetime, but right. Yeah, like like there are jobs now that are ChatGPT prompters where you have to learn how to think like an LLM to make it happen. And like, again, like someone made this point, which was that these things, that the only thing in fiction that we can really compare these to are the machine spirits from Warhammer 40K, where they're these gigantic, like, spiritual AIs that you have to appease in order to get them to do stuff for you. And the people who, like, live under them don't comprehend them whatsoever, which is really interesting because, like, almost nobody understands how these things work. They live inside of a black box, and we don't totally understand why they do the things they do. It's fascinating. It's a weird time to be alive.
And even if we interact with those things, it doesn't necessarily mean that we understand them. Like you say, it's like, anytime I recommend the Founders trilogy to people, I said, it's like one of the best modern examples of cyberpunk. And they're like, but it's fantasy. And I'm like, just get that out of your head.
Like, yes, you but also, yes.
Yeah. Yes, but no, but it's really wild to hear you kind of reminisce on the fact that it's like this fantasy trilogy that you wrote is now kind of coming to fruition in the real world in terms of not necessarily like prediction per se, because prediction is a bit of a bullshit thing when it comes to a lot of science fiction and whatnot. It's more like
people see the echoes of it. Yeah.
It's the echoes. Yeah. It's like the analogies that people can draw between certain things, but it's like, it's kind of scary that we're
spooky,
you know, because like reading the Founders trilogy and the power that Sansha the power that she wields by holding Cleft on her person is more than any one person should have. And I think we kind of underestimate the power that AI has in the hands of people who are pretty ignorant to the realities of it.
Yeah. It's kind of a weird thing where like I thought about writing a science fiction series, but the world is too incomprehensible these days. Like I think, you know, in the 60s and the 50s, you sort of, when technology was moving in ways that were like, frankly, more robust than now, like where you could see machines being built that would move Earth. We don't really see that happening anymore. We're not seeing new paradigms of moving around the world or creating new kinds of factories. That's kind of not what we're all about right now.
I think the paradigms that we're experiencing now are more invisible, that we don't necessarily have the perception to pinpoint like this is something that is changing the landscape of our world.
Yeah, like it's not hitting meat space as hard as we are expecting. Like the last really big change was electrification. Once we did that and we brought it to factories and started making stuff, that really changed everything, because then suddenly it was possible to leave your job on the farm and come into town and get like a job that really changed everything in a significant way. We really have not, although we like to think that the internet has changed a lot of things, that it has not changed things on that level. It is not like the idea of having a little wire in your house, and if you touched it to it, you could like wash your clothes without having to do anything. Like moving like physical items, like that is that's a level of change that I think we take for granted and it's very hard to comprehend. Like the idea of the oven, like you just have this little string in your house, you tie it to this big box, and now it cooks your food and you don't have to start a fire and there's no smoke. Like That's a level of change that I think that we really have no concept for anymore.
But even earlier on, it's like the ability for electricity to give us the capacity to do things past darkness. You know, it's like the sun sets and we can do shit. We can continue to do stuff as opposed to like we're gonna like cook by fire and then, you know, get like bad lungs and then go to sleep at like us today would say like that's an unreasonable hour to fall asleep. Like, what are you, child?
Right. As well as like how we built things. Like you had to build things with windows.
Yeah.
And you had to build things with chimneys. Otherwise, this room was useless. Like you could not inhabit it. It could be a closet, but like having rooms, chambers, hallways, things like that, that didn't have access to fire or light or the sunlight. That was a weird idea. So like, but like now with the internet and now with like how things have globalized so much and we've become like a global consciousness and a global species, it's like much harder to predict. Like, I think it's much harder to predict much farther than 5 to 10 years out. It's like, I think a stupid job to try and do that. And so that means to me that it's very difficult to work in science fiction. The simpler thing to describe the unreal world that we're working in is to place yourself in a situation of unreality, which is fantasy, and operate from there, because that's the only story mode with the toolkit possible to describe and articulate the weird shit that's happening now. As well as, I did not want to have a bunch of tech people yelling at me that I did stuff wrong. And so it makes it a lot easier to just make it up as you go, to have it run in parallel to reality, but not be enough from reality that everyone can criticize me.
Right. It's like, I don't want all that shit in the reviews and the comments.
Always the fear with sci-fi.
Yeah. There's that in guns. I find that the gun people are really big on telling you how you did guns wrong.
You wrote a book about guns, though. Yeah, so you doubled
it. In Like American Elsewhere, I referenced that a Glock has a safety. Apparently, Glocks do not have safeties, which to me is fucking crazy.
That is pretty crazy.
That there's a gun that doesn't have safeties. And they were like, well, it's just such a reliable weapons system. I remember that, weapons system. I was like, it's not a gun, it's a weapons system. It's like the Winnie the Pooh meme, you know, where it's Pooh and then it's Pooh in a tuxedo.
Yeah, yeah.
It's not a gun, it's a weapon system. Oh. But I was like, I still don't like the idea that it's so reliable that every time you pull the trigger, it goes off. I don't understand. Maybe someone could explain that to me. But they caught me on that one, and I got some grief over that. But
you're in Austin.
Gun people, I'll come for you.
You're in Austin, Texas. You're in gun country, man. You can go to a convention.
Austin, not so much. I mean, no, a little bit. You kind
of
got to
say Austin.
Austin. Texas in general, not necessarily Austin specifically.
Texas in general, yeah. There's a lot of shooting ranges around town.
Say, Adrian is Canadian. He thinks that we're all of us in America are in gun country.
I'm in Ecuador. I'm in narco country.
Well, yeah, so you're in Ecuador now. From Canada. Well, I want to touch a little bit on some of the themes that are in some of your work. So in both Divine Cities Trilogy and the Founders Trilogy, you're dealing with some pretty deep themes related to power structures and society. I just finished Shorefall last night. No spoilers for Locklands. But how
you're gonna
do you
cry.
Think... I know, I've been told that already. But how do you think that science fiction and fantasy offer a unique lens through which to examine these kind of challenging topics? And do you have any advice for writers looking to balance those kind of heavier themes with action, humor, wit, like you do in your work?
Yeah, I would say the thing that I'm most preoccupied with in the Divine Cities, Foundry Side, and the Tainted Cup is change, is how circumstances require change, how the evolution and suddenly the rights of people, the resources they have, permit them to change themselves, to change how they prefer to live, to allow them to become more of themselves, and how change often leads to conflict, to disruption, to situations that at first seem better, but maybe not are. And that's probably why a lot of my works are more akin to science fiction than they are to fantasy, because fantasy frequently looks backward. I'm not the first one to point this out, but there was a post today about how, like, if you were a kid who grew up before the internet, That it's a little like being an elf from Tolkien's world who saw the last light of the two trees.
Nice.
And I was like, oh, okay. But like that kind of speaks to that trope in fantasy of there once was a wonderful world, but then through the follies of men or through like mortals or whoever, things went terribly awry and now everything is broken and ruined. And if we could only get the right person on the throne, maybe we could regain some shred of that power. This kind of functions alongside the Garden of Eden, which is like once there was paradise, we fucked it all up. It's impossible to go back. We will never go back to utopia. But maybe if we prostrate ourselves and whip ourselves enough and behave in this certain sort of way, we will invoke the powers of the divine to be granted some amount of favor and recover some shard of utopia. What bothers me about this is it's anti-progress. Like, progress is not possible in these worlds. Because no matter how much you make things better, you're never getting back to the Garden of Eden. You're never going to get back to those two trees. You're just kind of making a shit show a little better. And that also, I think, doesn't really describe the reality that I know. Where, like, if you go back one, two, three generations, I think, like, although they are still people, like, the systems are substantially more, frankly, barbaric. Where if you go back three or four generations, the amount of death that a normal human being experiences is far, far higher than we have any comprehension of. Like, it used to be like half the kids born would die before the age of like five. That was how it was. If you were alive, you'd seen dead babies. You had to go to the funerals. You had to bury them. Odds are your mom died at birth, all kinds of stuff. You go a little bit further than that, then their odds are you have experienced some sort of insanely violent war that made absolutely no sense, probably race-based, probably faith-based. Maybe it was ginned up by some king or some ruler for some reason that you didn't comprehend whatsoever. You don't know. The lesson is that all of us come from ancestors who probably had insane PTSD, malnutrition, and serious CTE. They had brain damage. They were malnourished. They'd seen an incredible amount of death. They were constantly fighting insane levels of trauma that we probably can't comprehend. And the future was always uncertain for them. Food was scarce, undependable. Every winter you freaked out. Slavery was extremely common. Like, one of the things that was kind of crazy was reading about like the 1200s and like the 1300s. You don't think of really slavery being a thing in Europe. But it totally was. It
totally was, yeah.
Yeah, that's kind of skipped in some of these classes. Things were bad. Like, we're incredibly lucky to be alive right now. Things are insane as they are right now. Things could definitely get worse. There are lots of problems in the world. I do not deny that whatsoever, and we need to work on them with all of our might. But things were super bad. Like, I don't like... I can't recall the last time I took a shit by a tree, but that was the default mode. And wipe your butt with a leaf. You better pick a good leaf.
Don't pick poison oak, people.
Yeah, that happened to Stephen King one time. He wrote a story about that. And he was really? Four, like that.
Oh my God.
Yeah. So as a result, like I don't think that fantasy has an extensive toolkit for describing change as we know it, trying to manage the advent of industrialization and the way that that grants enormous resources to new kinds of people and what they expect from that. As such, that's why a lot of my stuff tends to function like science fiction, which is much more socially conscious, I think, of real world politics and real world conflicts. And in trying to predict, if I introduce this tool or this method, who would lose power and who would gain it and what would happen from that? That's like, that's a huge amount of science fiction stories out there. And I've always tried to make sure that my fantasy stuff kind of sticks to that. Terry Pratchett is a big inspiration for this, and that a lot of his the stuff that he did with Discworld was more science fiction like oriented, in that someone would find a magical process to make this thing happen, and then that would upend everything. And so that's always been sort of my guiding star for a lot of that. I'd say that the Divine Cities was a bit unique in that the tool that was used the most was history. The concept of history and how people use it in the present to form the societies that they want or to excuse what they want to do in the present. But history is fundamentally unknowable. We can't really access it and we can't really comprehend it, especially when it's hundreds, if not thousands of years ago. So you have all these guys who are trying to invoke the power of these gods that they've never seen and whose works they only have scraps of, and who only kind of, like, they don't really get what these gods are about, but they would like them to wipe out these people that they don't like right now in this moment. And like, so for that one, the gods work as a metaphor for history. That's how I kind of thought of that one. That's a little bit different from Foundry's side, which was, and the Founders trilogy, which was when I was trying to investigate my own feelings about technology. Because at the time, when I was writing it in 2014 to 2016, there had been this sort of agreement that technology was bad, that it just created lots of problems for everybody. That like big tech was ruining everything, that we were no longer capable of producing technological solutions for ourselves. If we did produce a technological solution that helped something, someone would exploit it and ruin it, and it would inshitify, like so much of the internet. And so I was like looking at that and poking it and wondering like how true this was. And the conclusion that I came up with is that there is a weird feedback loop between social programs and technological programs, like social progress and tech progress. And you're never entirely sure if this progress that we have right now, is it 100% from social work, from creating new systems of governance, from becoming more enlightened about the rights of others, or is this the result of technological process? Like, I would say, like, a lot of the comprehension of diversity that's happened now in the past 10 years, a lot of that's because of the internet. Because, like, suddenly it was a lot easier to share videos of these things that were happening to, like, black people. And, like, it gave them voices where they didn't have one before. And that created social structures that were still struggling to try and get that, to get applied in a way that actually results in real justice, which is really hard. But it was a weird conclusion that I feel like I came toward, which was that it's an uneven sort of slouching towards progress, where one end gets pulled and then the other one gets pulled, and if one gets too far ahead of the other or behind, it results in tragedy, which I think is true. Like comparison that I think of is like the First World War and the Civil War, where our abilities to kill each other far outstripped our abilities to heal one another. Like it was the First World War was when we didn't just have guns, but we also had phones and trains, which were capable of dropping off tens of thousands of people and putting them behind tens of thousands of guns and shooting them all at each other.
And then you look at the exponential progress between World War I and World War II. It's like the time frame actually quickened between those wars, and it's quickened ever since. Like the exponential progress that we've seen has been wild. And I think a lot of what you're talking about really applies to your newest book, The Tainted Cup, as well, which is a, you know, like a Sherlock Holmes and Watson kind of murder mystery, but blended with high fantasy world building and some similar to your other works, like a lot of politically and socially aware elements. So how did you kind of take this approach with The Tainted Cup? Because there's so much of what you're saying that rings true with how you laid out the world of The Tainted Cup, even though it's in the framework of fantasy and a murder mystery. How did you go about like blending genres in that way? These genres in particular, but then also applying the sort of intensive thought in terms of how you perceive the political and social and technological landscapes of our current age.
Well, one reason why I wanted to do this was that I got really fucking lazy. And I didn't want to have to do, because Founder Site and all that stuff took a lot of work of writing all those rules. And I was like, I want something way easier this time. And I have a fundamental belief in the back of my head that like 90% of stories are actually mysteries. Something happened. We don't understand it. Let's try and figure it out. And so I started thinking, and like I grew up on murder mysteries, and my wife and I watch lots of like murder mysteries. My mom and my grandma had a whole closet that was filled with like Dorothy Parker and Agatha Christie, not Parker, Sayers, and like Agatha Christie. About all of with all their stories, and a member that we would watch them on like A&E and PBS and all this stuff back in the 90s on cable. And so I've always been very much drawn to these stories, and they're also really simple. I mean, like, you got a dead body, you got to figure out who did that. Who did this is a very simple story construct. And so I started thinking about the idea of an empire. Like, I like the idea of something strange and a little bit unnerving. And so I had the idea of someone who is not high on the totem pole, not powerful, having to function within this larger construct that was this fantasy, like, empire. And at first it was going to be chaotic and really dark and strange and more dystopian. And then I kind of stopped and stepped back and I said, like, I don't think that a murder mystery series, the way that I'm thinking of it, like the classic drawing room stuff from the 20s, 30s, and 40s, I don't think that those are inherently dystopic. And I started thinking about like why they really work as they do. And if you read them, they're usually about someone who is like a lower class cop or someone who does not inherently have a huge amount of power. Like, this isn't a king. This isn't a prince. This is a worker or someone who's just smart and gets hired to do this, who goes through the systems of power and systems of order to deliver justice. Like, this is about the victory of order more than it is about how, like, through strength of will, we can inflict order. And it is interesting, like, these things were written in the 20s and 30s and 40s. Why would somebody want to see something about the victory of order? It's because there was chaos unfolding across the, like, whole goddamn planet where you had these people saying, like, the liberal, like world order has failed us. All the bureaucrats have failed us. We have to throw it all out and create systems that are driven by might and power. And a murder mystery is not about might and power. The guy does not win because he is bigger and stronger and beats them up. It's because he patiently talked to everybody and figured it out. Or just noticed somebody. Like, the best one probably is Miss Marple, who is a frail old lady who succeeds because she paid attention to her village. And whenever she meets a murderer, she knows a corollary for their nature by referencing someone she knew from her village. She is a regular person. And that's what makes these, like, that's where this power comes from. These are like normal people. And it seemed like now was a pretty good time to have an example of an empire that was generally trying to do the right thing and do good things and maintain order and have someone working as an investigator for that power. Like, you want to see these people solving murders because, you know, like, there's lots of problems with crime and punishment and all the, in like all the nations in the world right now, but it's kind of tough to say, I don't think we should solve murders.
Right.
You want to see that one get fixed.
That's kind of a like baseline for most societies. It's like, yeah, right. we don't want to just brush this under the rug.
Right, like, ah, it's fine.
No, like There are some debates about like shoplifting and car theft right now. Now, sometimes it's okay. We can let that one go. But murder, it's different. I had the idea of this empire and this person working as an investigator within it. I think something else that speaks to the age right now is stress and huge amounts of change and huge amounts of problems that have to be managed and can't be managed privately or like individually. Like, for example, the war in Ukraine, like there was, there were like, they had talks about how like it was ridiculous that the government was handing out all this, like all these weapons and things like that. Like this could be privately managed by private corporations. And it was like World War II was not privately managed by corporations. That wasn't how that one went down. It was the government that had to step in and do this. Same thing for climate change. It is not possible for private corporations to fight this incredible threat. We need something bigger. We need to make, and this was like sort of play on words that I was going with here. We need to make a Leviathan, like Hobbes's Leviathan. It's Hobbes, right? Get with the Leviathan? Am I crazy? Crap. All right. I think that's right. It's been a while since I thought of this.
It's all good, dude.
But the idea of the like state as this gigantic like entity that's capable of fighting big things. And what's bigger than a giant goddamn sea monster? Right. And so I had this idea
yes, you are correct, it is Hobbes.
Okay, thank God. I was about to start Googling, but I was like, it'd be kind of rude. This is my interview.
I can almost whatever.
But I had this idea of like giant sea monsters that would come ashore once a year and threat, like that would be immensely damaging and require a huge amount of effort and change and like intelligence, where you like, this can't be beaten with one big guy with a sword. This is not something that, like, you know, a champion can destroy. This requires teams of very smart people using their brains to defeat. And, like, that's the victory that the Empire has, is that is the victory of teams of bureaucrats working together. And that's kind of something, like, that I think that we haven't really respected in a long time. We don't like the idea of, like, a big public work anymore. Like, we don't really do big dams. We don't really do big bridges. We don't celebrate the people who create and do this. We, in fact, make it pretty hard for them to do this these days. We're trying to build things now.
There's less value placed on architects and the work that they do and city planners and the people who
basically... City planners.
Yeah. Yeah. Like, I have a friend who's a transportation engineer, and he's like, no,
that's got to be terrible.
Like, nobody thinks about this shit, which is why he went to Europe, where they do respect something like that. A little bit more, at least.
Yeah. But like nowadays, it's actually the thing that we do is we make it much harder to build these things where you average person can sue and sue and sue until the price of these things go up so much that they just get abandoned. So I wanted to sort of imagine a society that valued construction, that like a bit like Rome, like value construction, the construction of walls and bridges and homes and trying to find new ways to do stuff. And I started thinking about this like investigator and how they would go about doing it. And I always had the idea of the way that the story would work was it wouldn't be Holmes and Watson, but it would be a somewhat less well-known style of sleuthing, which was like Wolf and Archie, who are from the like Rex Harrison novels, I believe. It's Rex Harris novels. And the way that those works is that like Nero Wolfe is a genius. He's also 500 pounds and an asshole and refuses to leave his house. He likes to stay up there, live his own life on his own schedule that cannot be changed. He likes to take care of his orchids. He likes his beer. He has a private chef, Fritz, I believe is his name, that he insists create all these unique like dishes for them. He's a genius and he can solve anything, but he won't leave his house. That's up to like Archie, who is a little bit more of a slick noir type. He does all the chatter and the jabber and stuff like that. He likes a cold glass of milk and he likes women. But it's his job to go out there, talk to everybody, take notes, get it all figured out, and bring it back to Wolf, who then gets it all figured out. Like, it's like, and I started thinking of Wolf almost as like this computer in a box. You just go to the box, you consult it, and it says what to do next. And I was like, wow, that is really convenient for a plot structure. I love this shit. I started thinking about like having this like investigator, because I had chosen for a while there to have the magic in the story be like biomagic, where it was ways to like augment people to give them certain skills. And the main character's skill would be he would have a perfect memory that he could consult, like browse almost like a book, and summon up the perfect like recollection of what had happened. And so his brain was like a recorder almost. And so he would go and talk to people and come back and vomit all this information out for this person that was like waiting for them. And this person would be someone whose mind was so enhanced and so brilliant that she actually found the world too interesting to live in, where she would seek patterns in leaves and in the grains of wood and brick and things like that, and want to question everybody. And so she never leaves her apartments, and she lives almost all of her days blindfolded, where because she just finds the world too interesting. She's got to focus.
Too much stimulation.
Right? Too distracting.
Too much stimulation.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Too distracting. And as I started writing this, I realized like she couldn't just be like Sherlockian. There had to be something weird and a little bit threatening about her. And she's almost like a predator, like a caged predator. She's always hungry. She's always hungry for information.
She felt like a falcon or something like that kind of predator that is very intelligent, but the menace is not so obvious.
Raw meat. I mean, there's something very interesting about her. But it's
like you can see this person is like there's a sharpness to their way of perceiving things, to their intelligence. But there's also like there's some fucking sharp talons on this person too. There's something there.
Yeah. And so I realized that it's really not Wolf and Archie. It was Hannibal Lecter was the thing that was closest.
Okay.
So you've got a genius in a box who's hungry to learn about all this fucked up shit.
Yeah.
And really the thing that I realized was the moment where, like in the movie, Silence of the Lambs, because the books are not very good, I've personally found. There's the part where she starts to describe a thing found in her throat, and he goes like, and he suddenly says, like, was it a butterfly? And it's this odd moment of like, how the hell did you guess that? I was like, that's what the detective should be like. This creepy, unearthly, how did you divine this? And that's how I came up with Anna. And it took me a while to get there, actually. In the first take, Din was the crazy one and Anna was the more collected one, where he was like a crazy, drunken, insane person who was fighting like PTSD.
Well, that's very different from the Din that ended up on the page. Yeah.
Cool.
And so I sent it to my editor and he was like, I think this isn't working for me. I'm not sure why. Why does it have to be so troubled? And I realized that the real error is if you have a genius and someone who works for the genius, who's the main character, the genius has to be the crazy one. It can't be the main character who is the one like it can't be the Watson who's insane. And so that restructured everything for the story for me. And that was kind of one of the like moments that kind of helped it all like open up for me. And from there, they seem to work together where he is a little bit stiff. He's a little bit more at risk. He's trying to make money for his family. He's more reserved, more watchful. He's more still. He doesn't talk as much. And she's just bouncing off the walls, vomiting like information left and right, being a scandalous maniac. And he's just having to suffer through it.
Yes, and we love him for it.
Well, I feel like suffering through it is very, very applicable.
It is so important. But I want to talk a little bit about the structure, because the plot for The Tainted Cup is so delightfully intricate and so twisty. And so I'm just curious, what was your plotting process like for the book? Did you plot ahead of time? Did you kind of discovery write it? Like, what did that process look like for you?
I discovery wrote my way into sort of the best way to structure these things. And where there is a first small, mystery, that where something has happened and Din has to go look at it and bring it back to Anna, which she solves. But it doesn't lead to total conclusion. It suggests a greater mystery, at which point there is a giant, like, disaster or some greater crime that forces Din and, like, Anna to go to a secondary location that is far stranger, far more threatening, where the stakes really exist, that forced them to then go about and start to look at the real clues, and then things get really super de-duper naughty.
Yeah.
So naughty.
where there's a lot of information, there's a lot of little pieces out there, and Anna starts to slowly, like, assemble all the various crimes that have happened. And at some point in time, Din does some cool stuff with a sword. And then there is a final murder that gives Anna the final bit of information that she needs to conclude everything. That's more or less it. There's a lot in between then and there. One thing that was very critical was... in between having to step into, like, there's the greater place that they go to where the stakes really are. There needs to be a place in there of privilege and power that is immensely threatening that Din goes to. And I kind of decided that I was going to start to use these to poke fun at fantasy tropes. Because I don't know how clear it is on the page, but there's this very rich family that is immensely powerful and immensely altered, and everyone there is incredibly old. And they have this giant, ancient, like, mansion. But they all feel a little bit like elves, I hope, where the princess is this pale, white, perfect creature with purple eyes and silver hair.
Ethereal is the one that came to mind when I was reading. Yeah.
She's been augmented so that she releases, like, pheromones that you find, like, bewitching, especially men. She plays this role of being this elf princess almost to a perfect degree. It's only when you, like, see behind the ploy that you realize this is a dangerous person who's also an asshole and thinks that you're vermin. And I think that most elves probably would. I think that if elves were real, that they would think that we were rodents, more or less. And maybe I'm sure that there are stories out there where the elves are like that, and they have no redeeming qualities and are not the chosen children of God as they are in Lord of the Rings. But I realized that if we ever got to a place where elves could be something genuinely achievable, that they would treat the rest of us like shit. And that's what happens in the story.
But it's really good. Like, it seems simple when you kind of lay it out like that, but honestly, most mysteries are when you lay out the base facts of how this progresses and the things that happen, the general movements of the mystery. But obviously it's like when you're in the middle of reading it, mixed in with all the world building and all the character building and all that kind of stuff, which we will talk about in the next episode, there is, I think, more, there's more punch to the twists. There's more punch when the information is dropped at a specific time. And when discoveries are made, it feels more like mind-blowing because of the ways in which the world and the characters are reacting to those things. And we won't spoil anything specific about The Tainted Cup, but I think that's the first book I finished in 2024, and it's a fucking great way to start the year. So thank you very much, sir, and I highly recommend everyone pick it up when this episode goes live. But just bravo, man. Thanks for a good time.
Sure, absolutely. It was a lot of fun to write. I think that I kind of startled my editor that, like, I wrote it pretty quickly. One other rule that I had was that because, like, originally there's one character in there who's very, very altered to the point that they're almost an inhuman monster. And my editor very quickly was like, I don't think that you can do that. This is a murder mystery. They all need to be people. Like, if you have one character who is this monster owned by this, like, one group in here, that kind of undermines everything. Like, these all need to be people doing things for people reasons. And I was like, that's a really good point. So I actually had to go back and retool the final third of the story in a significant way because, like, you Like, that's not how a murder mystery works, because a murder mystery is about people solving people problems, which is a little tricky for a fantasy story, because people always want to, like, they kind of desire you to include more and more of the uncanny. But I think that the uncanny, like, is all, like, is in many ways a resource that people use to achieve people-based ends. Like, these are all humans doing human stuff. When they call upon the uncanny, it is often for very human reasons.
Yeah, and it's up to a certain point. Like, using a tool but without overusing it, and making the story feel a bit, like, too overburdened in certain sense, where it pulls the reader out of the experience as opposed to pulling them deeper into it. Yeah. All right, buddy. Well, winding down, MJ and I are curious, what does the future hold for you? And can you tell us a bit about what you are working on next?
I just finished the second draft of the sequel to The Tainted Cup. I don't know if the title and all that has been confirmed, but I'm really looking forward to it. It was a lot of fun to write. And I have started a couple pages of the third book in the series. I really like writing these. This is one of my more fun things to do. So I like really enjoy this world. I enjoy these characters and I enjoy the setup. I'm hoping to, like, if I had my druthers, I very rarely get my druthers, but it would be fun if I could just keep firing these puppies out and people keep reading them, because this is sort of like a tool I can use to attack almost anything that I find interesting with people that with, like, characters that I enjoy, and a world that's a lot of fun, and a format that is very flexible and can be used for almost anything.
Very flexible indeed. Well, man, yeah. I'm very excited for the future of Din and Anna.
I'd say, having finished book one, I can't wait for book two.
Yeah, man. All right, well, can you give listeners and viewers, A, a good bit of soundbite writing advice, and B, tell us a weird or random fact that you find to be utterly fascinating?
Okay, so writing advice, start as close to the action as possible is one of the things that Kurt Vonnegut said, and he's right. Trying to remember that is very, very tricky. I would always start with someone seeing the action coming, and right before it happens, like that's not a good way to put it. I was saying, like, the like inciting moment is an establishing moment for the characters, for the plot, the world, everything. Starting a book is the hardest thing you're ever going to do. Finishing the book is very, very easy, frankly. But starting it at the right point is the same thing as a spaceship trying to re-enter the atmosphere at the right angle so it doesn't fucking explode. So step very carefully, and you'll know that you kind of got it in the right place when it all starts firing naturally, when the words just kind of start coming. And so it is critical, like, the way to think about it is that you want to see the inciting moment that is going to draw the character into this world. And so you need to have some idea of the character, you need to have some idea of the moment, and some idea of the world that automatically pulls them into it, the same way that the like audience is pulled into it. That is the best way to put it. If it is, like, you know, if you are starting your story with a still scene or a hidden thing coming that no one can comprehend, that's not a great way to do that. Because that makes it much harder for the audience to grasp stakes, to grasp why this hidden thing is important. Like, things don't really kick off until you see someone getting pulled into the story the same way that the audience gets pulled into the story.
Agreed.
Bizarre fact, clownfish can change their sexes. If the female dies, then there is a fight among the clownfish group to become, and the strongest one becomes the female, which is, I think, right, up into a little bit of the sexual archetypes as we have them, which means that in Finding Nemo, the dad would have become a lady, and then Nemo would have fucked his dad.
Oh, no. That fact shook a turn.
Great lesson for Pixar fans out there.
I tweeted Finding, this fact.
The title Finding Nemo has a whole new meaning now.
Yeah. Yeah, I tweeted this fact out, and then someone quickly pointed that out, and I was like, man, it's 9:37. You can't be busting that on me at 9:37.
It's too early for that.
It's too early for transsexual clownfish incest sex. It's too early for that.
Oh, brilliant, man. Well, on that lovely on that lovely note, thank you so much for hanging out with MJ and I today. It's been a pleasure chatting, as always, good sir. If you could please let everyone know where they can find you online.
I am on Twitter at Robert J. Bennett. I'm on Blue Sky, is something akin to that. I don't remember .bluesky.social.internet.web. I am on Instagram. I post things occasionally. And I'm also on Threads, but I don't do a lot there yet. I'm waiting for a big reason to do stuff on Threads. And I have a website, I think.
And you got a bunch of books.
I don't have to do anything on my website.
You do have a website, and your author bio on there says something about your writing books and not updating your website. And I thought it was funny. Well,
that's perfect, man.
We won't touch that thing.
Awesome. All right. Well, you can also follow SFF Addicts on Instagram, Twitter, Threads, Blue Sky, all that shit at SFF Addicts Pod. You can follow me at Adrian M. Gibson. MJ, what about you?
Yeah, you can find me everywhere. At MJ Kuhn Books, all one word, or mjkuhn.com.
Perfect. That's it for this episode. Stay tuned next week for part two with Robert for our mini masterclass on connecting world and character. Now, keep reading, keep imagining, and we'll see you next time on SFF Addicts.